It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Manoush Zomorodi. On the show today, retracing their steps. After George Floyd was killed in 2020, there were massive demonstrations. But did all that marching really achieve much for the Black Lives Matter movement? Charles Blow isn't so sure.
We're in the middle of a massive backlash. It's manifesting itself in all ways.
Charles is an opinion columnist at the New York Times and a political analyst on MSNBC.
We have seen every form of voter suppression they could think of. We have seen attacks on protesting in general, because those crowds of people protesting, most of them were white kids. And so everybody rushed into the schools and said, we have to figure out what indoctrination is happening in our schools and shut that down. And so they've been attacking the teaching of Black history. So yes, we're in the middle of a massive backlash.
That backlash, Charles says, is all too familiar.
There are periods every 50 years or so where there's a surge in Black progress and then a massive backlash against that progress. And it happens over and over and over again. There's a surge of Black progress during Reconstruction and then the massive backlash of Jim Crow. There is the surge of Black progress, or the promise of it, during the Great Migration. And then there's the massive backlash, which manifests itself in Red Summer and then in the construction of segregation throughout the country. If you look at Brown v. Board of Education, right after that, the White Citizens Council is born. In response to it, you keep going with the Civil Rights Movement. Nixon basically, you know, he's campaigning when MLK is killed. He does all the nice things. He shows up and talks to Coretta. He goes to the funeral here in Atlanta. And then set about establishing the war on drugs, which supercharges mass incarceration. So I just see over and over and over again how backlash quickly follows any progress or moment in which people feel like there could be some real racial reckoning and leveling of the playing field. I, for one, am sick of this dance.
Here's Charles Blow on the TED stage.
Of taking two steps forward and one step back. Sick of being told that now is not the moment for the most ambitious efforts towards actual justice. I want to sidestep all of that. I want a plan for equality now. One that does not require marching and pleading. One in which Black people can access true American equality by their own actions. One that cannot be so easily regressed or reneged upon. And I just so happen to have such a plan. Energizing reverse migration by encouraging even more Black people to leave cities in the North and West and return to the South. And I want them to do so primarily to concentrate and increase their political power to have greater influence over and access to state power.
So your latest book is called The Devil You Know, A Black Power Manifesto. You also made a documentary called South to Black Power. Lay out the thesis that you have.
So I'm calling for Black people, as many as possible, to reverse the Great Migration, move back to the South. And I'm doing that because I believe that state power is essential to Black liberation in this country, and that states control lion's shares of many of the issues that Black people say that they care most about, and that Black people used to have very large percentages are majorities in many of these southern states, and they only lost it because of racial terror running them out, but also because of lack of economic and civic opportunity.
The very idea of Black power, you start your documentary by saying that we need to define it because the phrase kind of gets a bad rap because it can remind some people of white power, which is incredibly dangerous. So how do you define Black power in your mind, and why do you think it's an important term right now?
Right. So I do think it is important to define it relative to white power. When I read about what people have historically meant, when they said the terms white power. It was that white people needed to control all the mechanisms around them, political, cultural, and otherwise, to the exclusion of other people. Mm. When I say black power, I am saying that black people need to have more of a say in the power that is exerted over them. And right now, on a state level, they have very little of that say. They either live in liberal states that have relatively small percentages of black people and so are therefore dependent on white people in that state to agree with them, or they live in states that are hostile to them because, in fact, they are large percentages of those states.
You actually cite a couple of examples, historical examples, where people have tried this, and one was extremely successful. It happened in 1971, Vermont.
What happened in Vermont is fascinating. This is, the Vietnam War is raging, college kids are protesting everywhere, and two Yale law students write a paper in the Yale Law Review saying, you're not going to get anywhere this doing what you're doing, but you can have real power because you can simply move to a state and take it over, what they call radical federalism. And a writer who's writing for Playboy picks this up and writes a story, an article for Playboy saying, basically, take over Vermont. You don't need a number that is more than the people who live there. It's a much smaller number. And many of these young white hippies do just that. Some had already been moving to Vermont as part of the Back to the Land movement, but some moved after this article. And they eventually, after decades, transformed Vermont from one of the most conservative states in the North to one of the most liberal states in the country. And I thought, if these young white hippies can do it, why can't young black people do it? Now, in an ideal world, we wouldn't need to concentrate black voting power to achieve equality. Any composition of voters should provide equality for all people. But we don't live in that ideal world. In the world that we occupy, anti-black racism is still openly manifest in policy and power, and candidates who support those policies continue to win and continue to block progress. Reverse migration is already happening. Reporters have been chronicling this for at least a decade. I myself am part of the reverse migration, moving from Brooklyn to Atlanta in 2020. In fact, Georgia is a nexus of the reverse migration. In 2020, Georgia flipped from red to blue for the first time since Bill Clinton won the state. The success of the Democratic Party's gains in Georgia can in part be attributed to a rise in the black population in the state. In the early 1990s, when Bill Clinton won, black people were about a quarter of the state's population. In 2020, they were about a third of the state's population. Now, in theory, my proposal isn't partisan. The point is freedom, not party loyalties or party punishments. But in 2020, the candidates chosen by the vast majority of black people won, making Georgia a model for resurgent black power in the South, and for me and the plan that I advance, making Georgia proof of concept.
So talk to me about the numbers. What would you need to reach in which states?
Well, there are states. Mississippi, I think, is 38% black. Georgia is maybe 33. I think Maryland is 31. So you'd need hundreds of thousands of people in each place. Mm-hmm. I've identified a very specific subset of southern states stretching from Louisiana over to the Carolinas and up to Delaware. So that means that's not every southern state. That's not Texas or Tennessee or Arkansas. Then there's the calculation about where are the places with the greatest opportunities. There's a lot of economic activity in North Carolina, a lot of economic activity in places like Georgia. And I think that will be true in the long run. Mm. You know, if since 1970, 73, I guess, Atlanta has had an African-American mayor consistently, everyone. And so people looked at this, the city of Atlanta and the area surrounding it, as a safe place where Black power and Black prosperity existed, and that became a magnet. Mm. But the true hurdle for state power is that you capture a governor's seat. You capture a governor's seat, you have the power to veto. Mm. That is your first step to real power.
Did people not say to you, you know, we worked so hard to leave the South, why on earth would we go back?
People say that, and I also say, if you feel like you're being successful, you feel safe, you feel nurtured, you feel like your culture is celebrated, not just tolerated, if you feel like you found your place in the world, please stay where you are. If, however, you have been subjected to all of the ills of these northern western cities, a militarized policing and aggressive criminalization of Black and brown people, then maybe you could understand that there is another reality for you. There is no stop and frisk here in Atlanta.
Yeah, there's a fascinating scene in your documentary where you go visit a friend who did make the move to Atlanta.
So you are originally from a big city. Oakland, this is where a lot of people went during the Great Migration. You get into banking. You're incredibly successful at it. Mm-hmm. You could be anywhere. Mm-hmm. Why do you never go back to one of these big cities outside of the South?
I just felt safe here. I didn't feel that when I was in California. Even in D.C., I struggled being in D.C., and I was a full-grown woman. I was 48 years old.
Right.
I didn't feel safe again to win.
Right.
When I came home.
Back to
the South makes me feel safe, even with the history.
Wow.
I know.
The other thing is that we talk about people who did incredibly well in northern and western cities. We talk less about the staggering level of poverty that still exists there, and much of it is concentrated poverty because people, you know, you're not spread out. People are packed into small spaces with their poverty, which creates a whole other cascade of problems. Hmm. So if I look at the Black poverty rate in New York City, it is similar to the Black poverty rate in Mississippi. But we don't talk about those people.
Mm.
And when you look at where the Black middle class is doing best, that list is filled with southern cities, not cities in the Northeast, not cities out West. It is hard for me to even hear people say things are much better if you're in the North, if you've ever been through the poorest parts of Chicago, if you've ever been through the poorest parts of New York City. It's hard to even make that argument.
There is a woman, though, that you interview who is thinking about moving south and then decides not to.
And she's in Chicago. She decides that she wants to better her own community in Chicago.
So this is the strip I'm trying to turn to Black Wall Street. It's, to me, as bad as it looks, it's still opportunity. Because this is still a bus route and still a corridor. It just has no life to it. This is one of the six schools that was closed due to population loss.
And what are you planning to do with this school?
It'll be housing for individuals who typically are out of prison. Opportunities for them to have their families in the space as well. Some community opportunity.
Whole community
yeah,
in there.
Yeah. Yeah, it's going to be an institution. We're going to breathe life back into this institution. It's huge. I'm going to show you a little bit of the back.
I don't blame anybody for wanting to stay somewhere. If you were born and raised somewhere, that's home. I applaud people who get engaged to try to make their communities better. I just believe, ultimately, for the greater community, you need to consolidate enough power that you can access state power without it running through other people's sympathies.
Can I ask, I was looking through some of the criticism of your book, and there was actually one in the New York Times who wrote that the weakness in Blow's plan is that it requires faith in a political system that has consistently failed Black Americans at nearly every turn. Is that missing the point of what you're saying?
Completely.
Yeah.
Because you're in the political system regardless of where you are.
Mm.
And that same political system punishes you even more severely when you do not have enough power on your own to stand up against it. Mm. It is not that I believe that anybody has ever surrendered power willingly. It is rather that I find the argument that one is afraid of the fight to be insufficient.
So let's say this catches fire 10, 20, maybe a generation from now. Help us envision what life would be like in the United States. Because you say very clearly, don't put the idea of utopia in your own mind.
Right. No one else has to operate under the assumption that their racial majorities create utopia. So you can't put it on Black people either. That said, I do believe in the idea of just changing the power dynamic. If, first of all, if you get states where Black people could actually deliver a state, like they delivered Georgia, you then change politicians' relationship to you. When you're voting 80, 90% for one party because you can't vote for the other party because you believe that that other party really does mean you wrong, but the party that you vote for doesn't have to work very hard for your vote either because you are what sociologists call a captured constituency. Mm. So you're getting the least amount of bang for the power that you wield. You want to change that dynamic so that no party can win the United States without one or more of the states that you control. That changes their relationship and how they deal with you. That changes how they appeal to you, how accountable they feel to you, all of that. You can change that dynamic.
That's Charles Blow. His book is called The Devil You Know, A Black Power Manifesto. His documentary is called South to Black Power. You can see his full talk at TED.com. Thank you so much for listening to our show this week, Retracing Their Steps. This episode was produced by Rachel Faulkner-White, Katie Monteleone, and Harsha Nahada. It was edited by Sanaz Meshkinpour and me. Our production staff at NPR also includes James Delahousie, Matthew Cloutier, and Fiona Guerin. Irene Noguchi is our executive producer. A special thank you to Kayla Hoey at Magnolia Plantation and Gardens for her field recording support. And also to our friends and colleagues at NPR's Code Switch. Our audio engineer was Valentina Rodriguez-Sanchez and Ted Mebane. Our theme music was written by Ramtin Arablouei. Our partners at TED are Chris Anderson, Michelle Quint, Alejandra Salazar, and Daniela Balarezzo. I'm Manoush Zomorodi, and you've been listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR.